Well, welcome. Today's presentation called Resilience in a Time of Change. And my name is Doug Screeter, and I'm kind of the designated moderator here to get things going. This is a presentation from WDRT, community radio station in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And today's honored guest is Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and visiting professor in the graduate program in International Affairs of the New School. He has also taught at Yale, City University of New York, University of Utah, and University of Paris. His fields of study are Marxian economics, political economy, and international affairs. Professor Wolff host a weekly radio broadcast, Economic Update, produced by Democracy at Work and played nationwide by 120 radio stations, including WDRT here. Thought we'd give, for those that aren't real familiar with this area, just a bit of a background. Viroqua is the Vernon County seat, and we're a rural community of 4,500 people situated about midway between Chicago and Minneapolis in what is known as the Driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin. Agriculture and food production are major industries in the area. Of note is, and we know that this is certainly an area of interest for Professor Wolff, is that this is the headquarters of Organic Valley Farmers Cooperative, a billion-dollar farmer-owned cooperative and largest producer of organic dairy products in the country. We also have the Viroqua Food Co-op, a very successful member-owned food store with several thousand members, as well as in the area Woodman's Market, which is a worker-owned co-op with locations in nearby La Crosse, Wisconsin, and in the Midwest here. And we have other co-ops such as the, you know, the electric co-ops that have been here in business, member co-ops for a long time. Our panelists today are Dave Banner, has a PhD in leadership from Northwestern University and a retired professor in areas of leadership and organizational development and change. Toby Groats, BS in electrical engineering, University of Connecticut, and experience in areas of power generation. And I, Doug Screeter, PhD in economics from University of Illinois in Chicago, and also a retired professor of economics and business strategy. And just a bit on, this is an extension of activities of the Vernon County Resilience Initiative. Today's program is an extension of those, and our mission, and the three of us are actually founding members of that. Our mission is to increase awareness and development and develop resilience in Vernon County to better confront change in areas of the climate, economy, food, energy, water, immigration, and safety. The vision is that by 2030, Vernon County will be a leader in community preparation and resilience in confronting the challenges and opportunities driven by economic and environmental change. That's a bit of background, and we thought it would be good, Professor Wolff, maybe just to start out with a sentence there. How would you summarize what you see as the major drivers of change in the state of the economy in the U.S. at this time?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for taking the initiative to do that and to organize the way you have. I wish there were more parts of the United States that were concerned about these questions and were worried about resiliency, because they ought to be, as you'll hear me explain. You are ahead of the curve on that one and have every right to be proud of it. And my hope is that what you learn as you do this kind of work will be something you can and will share elsewhere across the country, because Lord knows they need it. The second thing I should say is I want to remind you of a good rule, which is not to get angry at the messenger, even if you don't like the message. I did not create the conditions that I'm about to describe to you. I wish I didn't have to. You will know as you hear me talk that if you want reassurance, you know, just watch TV tonight and you will get a soothing notion of everything is under control, which I'm afraid I have to tell you it isn't. Last thing by way of introduction. I was born not all that far away from you. I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, many years ago, when my father was working in a steel factory, in a company called the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. You may have heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've come a long way. I'm an older fellow, as you can tell. And I have to begin my talks by saying that we are presently, we here in the United States, and I've worked here all my life. I've been a professor of economics at half a dozen universities and all of that. I also ought to mention that I am a product of the elite universities of this country. You know, I went to Harvard and then I went to Stanford and I finished my education at Yale. So I've been to the places where we are supposed to think, I don't believe it's accurate, but we are supposed to think that somehow the best of the best is what happens there. I can assure you that's not correct, but I know that's hard to believe for folks unless you've been through it all. And I spent 10 years of my life going through the undergraduate and graduate economics and history programs of those universities. So here's the thing that you have to not blame me for, please. This is the worst condition of the American economy in my lifetime.
Wow.
And that means it's in your lifetime too, because we are all citizens here. We have lived, we've worked, we've earned our income. I'm married, I have two children, blah, blah. All of that makes me reasonably sure that what I'm about to tell you is valid, more or less, with adjustments for you and for the folks that you deal with in that part of the country. And I'll tell you another thing. I have good friends who are economists to my left politically and economists to my right politically. We don't agree on how we got into this situation, and we don't agree on how to get out of it. But here's what we do agree on. The sentence I just gave you, namely, this is the worst condition of the American economy in our lifetimes. And I find that a really remarkable coming together of perspective, given how many other things we disagree about. And it makes me a bit more confident than I might otherwise be that we kind of got the story. So let me try to summarize. I'm going to draw you a big picture because we'll have time to go into some of the more specifics as you prefer once I'm done with this little introduction.
Yeah,
so let me
think,
Chris, sorry.
What percentage of economists do you think really understand the complexity of the disastrous situation we're in right now?
Oh, well, lots of them. It's really not so much do they or don't they. Many of them get it. They have a suspicion, a sense, a feeling. Look, the questions you came up with and sent to me, they reflect already a certain level of concern, anxiety, wonderment, worry. I find that everywhere. I find that everywhere I go. I think the differences between those who have the feeling, have the insight, but then put it aside to get on with daily life, and those who, for whatever reason, stay with it, pursue it, go down that hole to see what else there is, and then they get really frightened because they actually do. So it's more a matter of degree of understanding than yes or no. I wish I could give you a simpler answer, but I think that's closer to the truth as I encounter it. All right, so let me start with the big picture, the global picture. And in many ways, this is the most important, partly because the United States has been able for so much of its history, because it was separated by these immense oceans from Europe and Asia, partly because it was so rich and powerful a nation in terms of what it could do economically. And then this peculiar historical moment after World War II, when we were unrivaled, when all the potential economic competitors and rivals, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, they were all destroyed in and by that war. And other than Pearl Harbor, which was awful, we weren't. There were no bombs other than that dropped on our country, no armies contesting across. We didn't have it. And I can assure you that that makes an enormous difference. Well, here's the problem. That is now over. And this is very hard for Americans to get their heads around, which I understand, because we were a kind of empire. We didn't call it an empire, but if you think about it, starting in 1945, we were the king of the heat. Half of world trade had to do with us. Our currency, the US dollar, became virtually the global currency. We set up the institutions that governed world economics, whether it's the IMF or the World Trade Organization or the World Bank. I mean, look at the very names of them and the importance of the United States in funding them, in leading them, in shaping their policies. We were extraordinary. And that's been true for most of the last 75 years, roughly 1945 to recently. You can say 2010 or 2015, doesn't matter. It's not a matter of this or that particular year. These are global trends. And so we got used to something here in this country, which, again, is very understandable, but has to be grasped. Every other empire, every other country that for whatever reason was in this kind of dominant position globally before, lost it eventually. No, it didn't last forever. No empire did. That's why we have to go to history books to read about the Russian Empire or the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, all of them. They came, they evolved, they were powerful, and then they faded away. Well, the United States Empire was born somewhere in the first half of the 20th century, depending on how you want to count it. It has had a really good run. It's over. And the most important thing for you to understand and for you to think about and for you to be resilient in the face of is that fact whose implications we are living through and whose implications are going to get deeper and more powerful literally with every month and year we go through. I'm going to give you just a little bit of a sense of it. Okay. For most of the last 75 years, there was one economic powerhouse, as I've told you, the United States. And it had a group of allies. And those are now called, for lack of a better term, in the media, the G7. The United States, Canada, Japan, Britain, France, Italy, and Germany. Those are the seven that were the center. Every third world country, Asia, Africa, Latin America, if it needed a loan, if it wanted to alter its trade situation, if it wanted to do projects to develop its own society, went to Washington or maybe to London or Paris to work all that out with the G7. Okay? That's no longer the case. There is now a second alternative economic power. And it's called the People's Republic of China. And like the United States, it has a group of allies around it. And those have now taken a name a few years ago called the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S. It originally stood for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They have since added six more countries, so that they are now 11, and there are many more applying to become members of the BRICS. Okay, now let's take a look at it. One of the ways we measure the footprint or the size of an economy is by something called the GDP, the gross domestic product. Roughly, it's a measure of the total output of goods and services in one calendar year. So the UN and many other agencies keep track of the GDP of the United States or of Canada or of any other country. Okay, we can add up the GDP of the G7 countries, the US and the other six. And if we do that, right now, as I'm speaking to you, it's about 29% of total global output in this on the planet that we all share. If I do the same for the BRICS, not the whole BRICS, just the first five that started it, that I listed to you. Ready? 33% of world output. The two lines crossed in the year 2020. That's when they were roughly equal. But they're not equal anymore, and the gap is widening, and the BRICS are now a bigger economic unit. What does that mean? It means everything. To every bank, every central bank, you know, every country has a central, pretty much every country has a central bank. The Bank of England, the Bank of France, the Bank of Italy, the Bank of Japan. We would have had one named like that, but politically, we couldn't solve that problem. So we have a funny name for ours. It's called the Federal Reserve, but it functions like a central bank everywhere else. Okay, our central bank, like other countries, has to keep reserves of other currencies to be able to manage the money supply. You know, an American importer has to pay, let's say, for importing Italian wine, he has to pay the Italian merchant from whom he buys it, and that merchant may want euros, because that's the currency that functions in Italy. So the American has to go and make an exchange. You know all that. The banks do all that, and they keep reserves. Well, the question is, what reserve you keep depends on what the world trade is using. It used to be all dollars. It used to be that every central bank in the world kept huge amounts of dollars on reserve to handle the demands of their entrepreneurs, their business leaders, and so on. They don't anymore. They don't need them because more and more world trade is conducted in other currencies. And the reason is, it's very good for a country that other countries use its currency as a reserve. And think very simply what it means. It means we in the United States can use our little green pieces of paper, our dollars, to buy the product of real work in other countries, the wine they produce, the machines they make, the clothing they fashion, and we give them little cheap pieces of paper which they hold on to. We don't have to give them the fruits of your farmers. We don't have to give them organic dairy product. We don't have to give them anything because we have something they need and want that doesn't cost us anything. Money, literally the printing of money. So this is very attractive. And there are many other benefits as well if everything is conducted in dollars. All of that is being reduced. I'll give you an example. Used to be 80, 85% of global reserves were held in dollars. Now it's around 50%. And that's a very dramatic drop. It changes everything. In every country of the world, every country, there is now an ongoing debate among the political leaders across different ideologies or different religions. The issue is, how do we here in this African country or this Latin American country, how do we adjust to this changing world, to the decline, here we go, the decline of the United States and its allies relative to the rise of China and its allies? And the amazing thing about BRICS and China is not only that they've grown, that we could have expected. I mean, they were very poor and they were driven as societies to stop being very poor, since nobody wants to be very poor. And so they focused on not being poor anymore, and they're doing it, which shouldn't surprise anyone. What is surprising, particularly about the Chinese and secondarily about the Indians, because India and China are the two poles of that alliance, is that they have been able to match the United States at the highest levels of technology. That iPhone that you use, that's as much them as it is us. Americans don't like to face it, but it is true. And that wasn't true 20 years ago, and it wasn't true 40 years ago, but it is true now. And to help us, let me remind you, it's a very different ride when your empire is growing. Much of the 19th and 20th century, we were riding up as a society. And that was a lot of fun because our incomes went up. We developed a culture in which we told our children, you will live better than we will, and my grandchildren will live even better than my children. I mean, that somehow it's built into the United States, this exceptionalism where we are, if you're religious, you know, blessed by God. If you're not, well, then it's the ingenuity or whatever of the people and the fertility of the land and so forth. All of that now has to change because the ride down is way less fun than the ride up was. And for those who are not prepared, it's even harder. That's why it's so important what you do, because resiliency starts with a recognition of why you need to be concerned about resiliency, because otherwise you don't know where to go with your concern. But this is a fundamental change. It's changing world trade. It's changing, for example, where populations are going. We're concerned, as you are in your list, with immigration. Well, let me be real blunt with you. Immigration is a consequence of what I'm telling you about. Large parts of the world are becoming unlivable. They're too poor. The climate change is messing them up. There's warfare as people cope with a changing world. And that's too scary and too disruptive. And people make the decision to leave where they were born and where they have their families and their homes and their businesses and take a risk of going to another country far away where they don't even know the language, they don't know how to. I mean, it's a trauma when people migrate. And when millions of people migrate, you have to look at deep global regions. Migration is a problem here. It's a problem in Europe. It's a problem in Asia. It's a problem everywhere. And putting all due respect, and we may disagree about this, putting up walls, that's not going to solve this problem. That's putting a Band-Aid on something that's a cancer. I mean, it may make you feel better. You got a Band-Aid there. But an honest doctor will tell you this problem needs a bigger solution. You're putting a Band-Aid that's not appropriate. I mean, it doesn't hurt, but it's not appropriate. I would argue with you, you're seeing people movements. These are all signs of a radically altered global context for what the United States is doing. And it will affect you. One last point, and then I'll be glad to stop.
Yeah, Professor Wolf, one of my concerns is that the effects of what's happening will influence large populations in large cities here, and it will be shifting from urban and rural areas, preferably or more exactly from the urban areas to the rural areas, as you say, as these economic conditions affect the inner cities.
Yeah, I think that, look, at this point, I wish it weren't so. At this point, mostly what we have to do is speculate. We can see the changes that are underway, but we are speculating as to where they will go and how they will interact and what resolutions will come out of them. If you're asking, is it possible that we'll have urban to rural migrations among others? The answer is absolutely that's one of the possible outcomes. But that would depend on many other things. I think, for example, here's a bigger question. Where in the world are we going to get a system that answers the question, which in our culture is fundamental, which is, where are the jobs going to be? You're not going to have movement from urban to rural if there are no jobs in the rural for masses of urban people to go to.
Yeah.
They're not going to want, I mean, they may enjoy exchanging homelessness in the city for homelessness in the country, but that's not going to be a major attraction. For this kind of movement to happen, there has to be something about the rural that solves a problem that the urban isn't able or willing to solve. Otherwise, you're going to have what we have now, growing unemployment, if you look at it really, certainly growing homelessness, because but those are themselves the beginnings of reactions to an economy that's going down. Look, to be very simple, when an economy goes down, like we are, and we will continue, one of the things that can happen, doesn't have to, but often does, is that those who have the wealth and the power to hold on to the standards of living they enjoyed on the upswing will be doing their damnedest to hold on during the downswing. But the problem with that is, if those at the top 5% or 10%, however you count it, if they're successful, if they can hold on to their standards of living, it will mean that the broad decline will be even worse for those not in the 10%. We are living through that. We are living through a situation where half the American, according to the Federal Reserve, half the American people do not have $400 of a savings account to turn to right now if an unexpected expense, God forbid, you know, someone gets sick in your family or your car dies or whatever it is. Half the people don't have that. Meanwhile, I don't want to pick on Elon Musk, but why not, right? He has hundreds of billions of dollars. You can't sustain this. You can have it's a hard to sustain on the way up. It's impossible to sustain on the way down. But we are doing that in our society, and it is ripping our country apart. I mean, you can see it in the level of hostility, you know, between Republicans and Democrats and different parts of the country and all of that. We are not, that's why I'm appealing to you. We are not facing the generic contextual problem we have. We're getting angry at one another as we try to hold on. We'd be a lot better off if we tried together to do something about a ship that has some holes in the bottom and that needs attention for those holes. But we're not. We're fighting who gets to sit in the front and who has the cushion. And very typical, not unusual, means we're like a lot of other people. But it's a luxury we cannot afford. And we're about to go to in a very bitter election campaign. It already is. Look what we're looking at. We are looking at very, very serious ripping apart inside, and that isn't unusual when you have a society that disintegrates. If you're worried about resiliency, maybe one of the bad pieces of news I have to give you is that you can't do that alone. You can't really solve your resiliency problem in your area. You have every right to focus on where you live and where you work and where your people are. I get that. That's always true. But more than usual, you are now linked up to things happening all over the world that will impact you. You know, as the world income shifts, they're going to be squeezes on income here. It's already happening, and growing incomes in other parts of the world. Let me give you one example because it'll affect you. Over the last 30 years, huge number of American corporations have moved operations out of the United States, as I'm sure you know, and most of them have gone to China and other countries too, India, Brazil, and so on, but particularly to China. Okay. Why did they do that? They did that because it's profitable. The Chinese basically gave them lots of incentives, above all, a cheap labor force, well-educated by world standards, quite disciplined, used to working, coming on time at 8 o'clock and staying till five or longer, and very cheap, especially compared to what they were paying their American workers. So they went, no mystery. That's the history of capitalism. You go to where, you know, I'm talking to you from New York City. I worked in Massachusetts. New England was where capitalism really was wonderful for a while at the beginning. And then the capitalists moved. They moved to the Midwest. They moved to the Southwest. You know the story. It's the history of our country. Well, the movement doesn't stop at the national border. They left. Same companies left and went to China. Okay, what does this mean? Well, it means that in China now, when the Chinese recruit companies who are still doing this, haven't stopped, they say to them, here's what we offer you. The cheapest labor force, highly skilled, and the fastest growing and largest market in the world. Well, that's a no-brainer. I've been a professor in a business school. I teach, and we all do, we teach American kids who want to become businessmen and women that you want to succeed, go to where the labor is cheap, the market is growing, and it's already big. I mean, China wins. General Motors produces and sells more cars in China than it does here. They know where their future is. And you can yell and scream and call Chinese leaders bad names the way our president does. But the folks sitting at headquarters at GM or Ford or any of them, they know where their bread is buttered. And they have been going there and they go there. A week after Janet Yellen, our Treasury Secretary, leaves China, the head of GM arrives. And he gets a wonderful welcome and a fantastic banquet dinner, and they fall all over him, and he responds in kind. It's like night and day. If you're aware of these things, you know. Well, that's going to mean that incomes are rising in China because of the development, and that's true. And you know what they're getting a taste for? I'm going to scare you now. They're getting a taste for organic fruits, vegetables, meats, and dairy. They didn't know about that before. Now they know. China has a big pollution problem, so they really have a need for food produced away from that pollution, without the pesticides and without the other things. Okay, they're going to produce that stuff, and that's going to be competition for you. If you want an example, I taught at the University of Massachusetts. It's in the western part of Massachusetts. There's not much industry in that part of Massachusetts. That's concentrated, you know, in Boston and Worcester, the eastern half of the state. So what do we have in the western part? Apples. Guess what? Our apple industry is dying. Why? Answer: importation of Chinese apples. They've got the refrigeration down. They've got the shipping down. And they can produce apples cheaper, and they bring them, and Who would have thought that a rural area focusing on apples would care about China, you know, 10,000 miles away? Well, that's the way this is working. The Chinese are everywhere. They're a very industrious people. They have matched us everywhere else. To imagine that they're not going to match whatever you are interested in is naive. If it hasn't happened already, here's my guess. It will. Now, they won't always win that competition, and Americans will find ways to push back, no doubt. But I want you to get that's a different game than the one we've been playing for 50 to 60 years. We didn't have competition, and we got enormous benefits, but we are also now not really well equipped to compete very successfully. That's why you see the government having to step in, doing what ideologically we are not supposed to be doing. The government is funding one industry after another. Computer chips, electric cars, solar panels. I mean, I could go on all day. The government is subsidizing these industries. Oh, yes, we hear stories. The Chinese are doing it, which, by the way, they are. And other countries are cheating, which, by the way, they are. But they always did. And the United States does its share of subsidy and cheating, too. And we were doing real well despite all of that. Now we cannot. And that's not coming back. And the more the government subsidizes, the more you're going to get the people that are on the short end of the stick, which are now more than a majority of our people. They're going to be looking at the government and being angry and bitter as they watch the subsidies go over there. And they're saying, I don't have a home. My kid's school is a disaster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I am very worried. Now you'll see why I started with this is the worst condition of the American economy, because I don't see, if you ask me, is there a solution coming? There might be, but I don't see it. And I spend my time studying, you know, everything I can get my hands on about the American economy, and I don't see anyone else pointing one out to me either. And I ask others the same question you're asking me. So my feeling is what we need most, and maybe this helps, we need people to worry about it. You're doing that, and that's why you're ahead of the curve.
That's probably a good transition point for some questions here and kind Please. Of focusing on resilience possibilities. I know that we don't have control over much, but what can we do as individuals? Maybe. I mean, you know, as you said, we're doing what we can. But one of the things I wonder, what are you telling? You mentioned you had a couple kids and maybe grandchildren. I know I have a couple young 20-year-olds. What would you be advising them?
Okay, the first thing I do, and this is advice I not only give my own children, but I still teach. I'm a visiting professor and stuff like that. So I still deal with students. And they ask me, of course, the same questions. Yeah. And my advice to them is the following. Contrary to what you might have thought, here's my advice, don't concentrate narrowly. Don't think you can second guess the future in terms of deciding what to major in, what course of study to focus on, what to commit to in terms of education, training, experience. Resiliency now, more than before, requires you to be thinking literally about multiple different fields you might go into. Be diverse. Spread yourself out. Whereas before you might have thought it's wiser to spend a lot of time in a narrow range and get really good at it versus spreading yourself across too many areas so you're not quite as good in any one of them. I would argue don't do that anymore, because your best preparation for the future is not to be overcommitted to one thing. be able to move, be able to shift, be able to have a little bit of knowledge about other areas, whether you're a farmer in terms of what you plow your field and what seeds you put in or what animals you choose to raise, or if you're not in agriculture in your other areas. Don't narrowly, here's advice that might surprise you. Don't narrowly focus on what's really the most profitable thing right now. Because what is that way now probably won't be 2 years from now. And then you'll do real well this year and you might do real well next year. But you're setting yourself up for a big fat fall because you've put, you know, as your mother might have said, you put too many of your eggs in one basket. Don't do that. Don't do that. You are not, that's a luxury you cannot afford. You cannot say, my grandpa did this, my pa did this, I'm going to do this. This is proven. Even if grandpa and pa did real well, you just can't anymore go that way. That's why I'm stressing how much has changed. That change is going to get to you sooner or later, one way or another. I can't tell you, I wish I could, how that's going to happen. But I can tell you it is going to happen, and that therefore resiliency, look, let me do it this way. One of the reasons the Chinese have done as well as they've done has to do with the fact, and people think that comes out of their socialism or their communism. I don't think it might, but I don't think so. I think that's a very practical awareness that they entered the world economy and there was already a top dog, the United States and its allies. And they knew that was the stand. If you didn't outcompete them, you weren't going to make it because they were going to defeat you. The United States, you know, we were the car producer, the airline, you know, everything, the greatest, the biggest, that came from here. Okay, so they went, they didn't say, let's do what's most profitable now. No, no, no. Do without profit for 3 or 4 years, but figure out where you have the best chance of making the kind of breakthrough that will give you the ability to compete. So years ago, almost 10 now, they started working, losing money on producing electric vehicles and the battery needed to power them. Now they're the number one producer of batteries and electric vehicles in the world. President Biden just announced 100% tariff. So if you want to buy a $20,000 electric truck from China, and they're super good, it'll cost you the $20,000 and have to go to China to pay for it, plus another $20,000, 100%, go to Uncle Sam in a tariff. It'll cost you $40,000. If you go to France today, you see Chinese electric vehicles all over the place, but you don't see them here. And that's not because they're not good at it, not because we don't need it and want it. It's because they went to work and they produced the best thing. We got to do it. You've got to think broadly about what is a strategy for the community. Do that. Don't do what's maximally profitable right now, which is a new and different way for American businesses to think.
Quick question here. So if, in my opinion, democracy failed because it could be purchased and this whole system we're living under comes apart, do you see it that possibly the United States will break up into separate regions as did the Soviet Empire?
I'm afraid the answer has to be yes. The notion that whatever we see abroad can't happen here, that was never true, but it is not true now. Absolutely. Look, if you want my honest opinion, I think our leaders, and I think this is true for the Democrats and the Republicans alike, they're mostly doing, my wife's a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been married for 50 odd years, you know, and so she's taught me how to think psychologically, whether I wanted it or not. Anyway, but she, you know, I have learned a lot from her, and the word she uses to describe our political leadership is, she says, they are in denial, which again isn't surprising. They don't want to be the leader who says, like I just said to you, we're in decline, because people will be angry at the messenger who brings the message. They know that he didn't do it, but they don't want to hear it. So our leaders are all like cheerleaders, you know, we're the greatest, we're the greatest. No, we're not. We can get there again, maybe, but it'll take a lot of work, and we got real competition, which we haven't had for almost a century, and that changes everything. But no, I think our leaders are blind to all of this. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk about it. Look, I know some of them personally. So let me do something I shouldn't do.
Okay.
But you may know this because I mentioned it publicly. My classmate at Yale, who took the same courses I did from the same professors in the same room, was a woman named Janet Yellen. Mm-hmm. She's now the Treasury Secretary. I know what she knows about economics because it's the same thing I do. We were literally trained side by side, right? So I watch her. And what am I going to tell you? She knows better than what's coming out of her mouth. And look, I understand she's part of a political administration. She has to, you know, she has to be part of the team. I get all that. But I also know what I know, which is she knows that the situation is not the way it's coming out of her mouth. And how she resolves that, I don't know. I don't know her personally, so I can't attest to that. But I can tell you that even at the highest levels, if they're not in the public eye, they know that we're in trouble. And if you push them, your question comes up. What happens if we can't sustain it? If the whole world is going to be using Chinese electric trucks, Chinese electric vehicles, Chinese batteries to run them, and they're all buying them at 20 grand, and the United States is the outlier paying 40 grand for the same truck, this is not a sustainable arrangement. We're going to be outcompeted by all the companies abroad who can buy fleets of truck for 20 grand each, whereas the American equivalent has to pay 40 grand for the same friggin' truck. This is, you have to think like that, otherwise you're going to make unspeakable mistakes. And it may be popular. It may look like you're tough and you're not letting the Chinese get away with cheating. But after you get happy with that, telling yourself that story, you haven't solved the problem.
We're getting close towards the end, I think. And I think one thing, question we'd like to ask, we both talked about this quite a bit. Where did gold and silver and what kind of currency, how does that play into a collapse of the Fed or a collapse of the banking system? What kind of currency would we be using if there was a breakup?
Well, you're seeing it already. First of all, I don't know if you pay attention, but the price of gold has been going up and up and up. Yeah. And that has some short-term reasons. Sure, the war in Ukraine is being lost by Ukraine. Russians are winning that. And the situation in Gaza is unsustainable. And the whole world wonders whether the Israelis will try something with nuclear weapons. And who knows then? You know, we'll all be gone by, it's unthinkable, so we don't go there. But because of that, people are looking for, quote, safe havens. Now, they used to go to the dollar when they looked for a safe haven. They would accumulate dollars for the logical reason that that's going to be the last one to go because it's the biggest and the strongest economic unit, which we were. But they're not doing it anymore. So the only honest answer to you is, you have to diversify. It's again, like what I said to you before, don't focus narrowly. The rest of the world is reducing, not eliminating, but reducing the dollars it's holding. And you know what else it's holding? Euros, Chinese yuan, Japanese yen. They're diversifying their holdings and gold as well. That's why you see the price happening. And you and I and individuals basically have to try to do that. You can hold gold in a variety of ways. If you've held gold over the last, give you an idea, over the last 6 months, you're 20% ahead. There's almost no other investment where you could possibly have made 20% in the last few months. with very little risk. And so, you know, you could sell it. I mean, these kinds of results are going to lead people just to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the rest of the world, I don't know how you folks look at it, but in the rest of the world, I read French and German, and that's because of my family. So I spend a lot of time studying European newspapers. I read them every day. Okay. In the rest of the world, the United States lost the war in Vietnam, lost the war in Afghanistan, is losing the war in Ukraine, hasn't won the war in Iraq. Okay. That's how they see it. And that means the United States isn't what it once was. You know, it was the great ally that came in and put the kibosh on Adolf Hitler and the Japanese in World War II. And we came out of that the hero, if you like. But we're not in that position anymore. You have to understand it. You don't have to like it, and you don't have to agree with it all. But if you make believe that none of that's happening, you're going to make one mistake. Look, the United States thought that the war in Ukraine would be over in a few months. Russia is bigger than Ukraine, but that didn't matter because the West would support Ukraine with guns and money and all of that. But it was a mistake because they didn't understand that Russia is part of BRICS. And BRICS now matters. And the Russians turned to the Chinese and the Indians, who bailed them out, who bought the oil and gas they couldn't sell anywhere else. So the sanctions didn't work. The ruble didn't collapse. Russia didn't disintegrate. Could it still? You bet. But no. And I think, you know, you have to face it.
Well, thank you very much, Professor, and it's been very enlightening, I think, for us, and given us much to think about in our efforts to develop more resiliency, and we know that you are continuing to address these in your weekly broadcast, these issues, so thanks again for joining us and giving us the privilege to have some time with you.
And I think that anyone watching, once we stitch our videos together here, can go to verdoncommunity.com, which is our resiliency website. That's Viz and Victory, ERON community.com. That's how we're trying to address local people here and to prepare for what's coming. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
We shall live in peace. We share living peace someday. Darling, here in my heart, yeah, I do believe we shall live in peace someday. We shall overcome someday.